Thank you, Beth. How is everybody today? Awesome. I know you're all recovering from lunch, so we got to get that energy up. So our talk is, as Beth said, Stealing the Best Ideas from DevOps, a Guide for System Ends Without Developers. A little bit about ourselves. My name's Tom Limoncelli. I'm the SRE manager at StackOverflow.com. Who here has heard of Stack Overflow? One, two, okay, some of you, awesome. I've been a system administrator for much too long, and I blog, and I tweet, and I've written a couple books.
I'm Christine Hogan, principal network engineer, who here has heard of AT&T, small company. Yeah, one or two, okay. And obviously written a few books with Tom and been in the industry for a while. So we're here today to talk to you about DevOps.
Right, but and I love talking about DevOps. We love talking about DevOps, but there's something else that I love talking about, and I want to talk about that just for a little bit first. And that thing is punk rock. And who here also is a fan of punk rock? Okay, awesome. So this next couple slides might be, you know it already. What is punk rock? Well, punk rock is you take the principles of punk rock and you apply them to music. And you get something like The Clash, right? Or you take the principles of punk rock, apply them to music, and you get The Ramones, right?
But Tom, what are the principles of punk rock?
Oh, I apologize. I'm using a term without defining it first. Okay. So you all know okay. So according to Joe Strummer, you all know who Joe Strummer is, right? Okay, I'll assume that much. The principles of punk rock are, one, do it yourself, two, anyone can do it, and three, everyone can be an artist. Okay? Now we'll go back to what we were talking about. Okay, so punk rock. So in addition to this, you have, what's the superficial view of punk rock? How does, the media talk about it? Well, the media talks about punk rock as being a bunch of guys that wear leather jackets and swear a lot and smoke and sniff glue, right? So let me survey the audience. What's important, the principles, the results, or the superficial aspects? So who says A? Okay, and who says B? And who says C? Okay, they have kind of a bell curve going, all right. So I'm actually in the A camp. I think the principles are important because you can apply the principles to more than just music. For example, you could apply the principles of punk rock to poetry, and you get the works of Patti Smith. Or you could take the principles of punk rock and apply them to literature, and you get zines, right? Now let me resurvey the audience. Who says what's important is A? Okay, a couple more people, good. B? And C. Still a couple hands on the C. Okay.
Well, that's all very interesting, but I think now we'll move on and talk about DevOps, since that's what we said we were going to do today. And the thing with DevOps is you can take the principles of DevOps and apply them to software engineering and get something awesome like Etsy. Or take the principles of DevOps, apply them to software engineering, and get a whole load of other cool sites like Netflix, Stack Overflow, and so on.
Hold up, wait a minute. You haven't told us what the principles of DevOps are.
I'm sorry, Tom. So you could ask different people and get different answers to what are the principles of DevOps. But I'm going to say that the principles are the three ways of DevOps, the small batches principle, and minimum viable product. Good enough?
Okay.
So going back to where we were, take the principles of DevOps, apply them to something, and get something cool at the other side. There's also the various different tools that you use for DevOps. So you might use Git or Jenkins, Puppet, all of these different things that you've heard of. And you can even get vendors who will come and sell you something and say, buy this great thing, and then you'll have the DevOps. So if we split this into categories, we've got category A, the principles, B, the results, and C, the tools. Who thinks that what's important is A, the principles? Reasonable, few people. How about the results? Gosh, there's a lot of people who think the tools are important then, because you're mostly not answering. Okay. Who thinks the tools are what matters? And everybody else is agnostic. Okay, good. Well, again, I'm firmly in the A camp.
Why is that?
Well, let me explain, Tom. It's because you can take the principles of DevOps and apply them to, for example, the employee onboarding process and get increased productivity. Or you can take the principles of DevOps, apply them to failovers, and get increased reliability. The tools that you use are different, but you still apply the same principles and you get some awesome results. So now, who thinks the principles are the most important? Yeah, okay, improvement. And the results? Okay, and the tools? Yes.
You must be a vendor.
Okay, so that was a quick overview of the principles of DevOps, the three ways, small batches, and minimum viable product. Let's look at those in a bit more detail. First off, the three ways of DevOps. This comes from the Phoenix Project. It's an awesome book. If you haven't read it, pick up a copy. It's a good read. And what it talks about is, or what the three ways are about, is a way to improve complex processes. Complex processes are ones that involve multiple different teams doing different tasks along the way. So in the software engineering world, this is your project manager who gathers requirements, your developers who build something, QA who test it, and the operations people who roll it out. And traditionally, they're all in separate silos, and they don't necessarily talk to each other very much. And so the traditional DevOps with software engineering, you take the three ways of DevOps, and you look to improve system thinking, and you want to amplify feedback loops and develop a culture of continual experimentation and learning.
So those are the terms used in the Phoenix Project book. And the Phoenix Project book is written by some really smart people, and they use really smart words. And also, Christine's really smart, and that's why she uses those words. But I'm more of, let's say, a plain-spoken guy. So let me explain these three things a little bit differently. I look at the three ways of DevOps as, if you want to improve a complex process, there's three categories of things you can do to make it better. You can improve the process itself, you can improve the communication between the people involved in the process, or you can make it possible to try new things. You can't improve things if you can't if there's no ability to try new things. Now, we're not going to talk about all the various techniques that are used, but I do want to say that, so the goal is to make things better. So the process might suck, and you want to try to make it awesome, right? And communication within these organizations or between the silos might be lacking, but you want to make it comprehensive. And your ability to try new things might be resisted in your organization, and you want to create a culture where it is constant and enabled.
But actually, let's be fair, it can be worse than that. It could be that the process doesn't just suck, but it's non-existent. Communication's not just lacking, but it's punished unless you go all the way up the chain and all the way back down again. Or it may be that trying new things is not only resisted, but people are so afraid of doing that that they're paralyzed.
So let's apply the three ways to some non-software engineering situations. For example, the onboarding process we mentioned before. So recruiters recruit, HR brings people into the company, IT now has to set up their accounts and their computers and stuff, and then the team has to assimilate them into the, assimilate the new employee into the team. In the 90s, I worked at Bell Labs, and our onboarding process was awful. Don't know if it was this way for all of Bell Labs, but definitely the part I was in, we had problems on all three of those levels. Our process was terrible. It was ad hoc. We improvised our way through it every time. It was broken in a whole list of ways. Communication was terrible. IT was given no warning that new employees were about to arrive to the company. In fact, at one point, a manager actually told me that the IT team was not allowed to know that new employees were coming until their first day. And trying new things, well, was really out of the question. Or you could look at it as we were trying new things every time because we had no process. So as a result, new employees were unproductive for their first 4 weeks. We were hiring the world's best computer scientists and bringing them to Bell Labs. And for the first 4 weeks, if they wanted to check their email, like a couple times a day, they would have to borrow someone else's computer. That's embarrassing. And so the first impression we made was, wow, I've just joined a really messed up company. What's wrong? And of course, everyone blamed the IT department for all of this. Why? Because that's what you do. So we applied these three ways, and we made a much better process. The process, and this began by just getting all the people involved into the room, all in one room, so we could agree on what's the hiring timeline. You know, what do we do 2 weeks before the person arrives, 1 week, day of, etc. We improved the communication. In fact, by just identifying a process owner for each step, that alone improved the communication. Because if something went wrong, we knew who to talk to. We were able to try new things. Now, that story is from long ago. This slide is actually, what are some new things you could be doing today? A lot of people track their onboarding process in a shared spreadsheet, like a Google spreadsheet. You could try using Trello instead and have more of a Kanban strategy. Or if you're starting to hire in droves, it might be more appropriate to build a custom application, in which case you have this, now you're involving developers, which means, you know, eventually everything turns into a software engineering problem. And we're able to make efficiency gains in other places. So as a result, new employees were productive on day one. The first impression we made on new employees is this is a great company which cooperates and acts efficiently, and that sets an expectation that they're supposed to be cooperative and efficient and work well also. And it was less work for everyone else, and it opened the doors to new automation opportunities related to accounts and other things. And so there are plenty of different opportunities in every business where things are siloed and these techniques will help improve your situation. Customer support escalations. Often a problem goes from the customer to your frontline support people to a second tier or maybe some kind of product management. Product fulfillment. When I was at another company, we were making appliances and sales. The CFO that approved a sale contract, the manufacturing and the shipping, these four things were very siloed, but we were able to improve the process by using these techniques. So that's, in brief, the three ways of DevOps.
Okay, the second thing that I mentioned earlier was the small batches principle. So let's take a little look at that. I don't know if you've noticed, but it seems like everything is small batches these days. Small batches are better. It's some artisanal beer or coffee. You want a small batch coffee, not a great big enormous brew. Stuff in the grocery store is all small batch this and small batch that. In fact, even dog food, you can buy small batch dog food. And I don't know about you, but my dog won't eat anything else. So what is small batches? Well, it means doing the work in small batches rather than one big batch. And we say that that's better. So instead of work, work, work for a really long time, then check at the end to see if you've done a good job, you do a bit of work, you check it, you work, you check it, you work, you check it. You find errors earlier, and it enables you to fix any problems a bit sooner.
So our example in this category is related to how Stack Overflow does failovers. This is a very simplified network diagram of the Stack Overflow network. And so basically, when you go to stackoverflow.com, everything happening there, for the most part, is coming out of our New York data center. And we have a duplicate data center, our disaster recovery site, in Colorado. And we keep New York and Colorado exactly the same, or we mostly try. Oh, and here's what a failover looks like. Great. Now, the problem is that we often have big batch failovers. So the amount of time between any two failovers is an opportunity for more and more version skew between the two sites. So we have this accumulation of differences that can happen the longer we go without a failover. And also, there's another, so the number of changes becomes a bigger and bigger batch. And another thing that contributes to this is that as we hire new SREs, the new SREs haven't been through the failover process, so if they're on call when this happens, that could be a bad thing. We learned this the hard way in 2013. This failover was a particularly big batch. We thought it was going to take about an hour to fail over. We knew we were failing over ahead of time, so there was plenty of planning. We thought we could do it in an hour, but instead it took 10 hours. And during about 15 minutes of actual downtime, but it took 10 hours, we learned that doing the failover required hands-on from three different teams within the company. During those 10 hours, more than 30 bugs were filed related to software, documentation, other things. We also learned that the failover could not be done if Nick was on vacation. Nick was our single point of failure, right? Now, normally in business, if something is risky, you say, well, it's risky, we should avoid doing it. But avoiding doing it would just make the next batch even bigger. So what we needed to improve this situation was small batches. We needed handcrafted, artisanal, small batch failovers. So we started this policy of, if we haven't been forced to do a failover due to an outage every couple months, we were just going to do a failover anyway. So this way, the number of potential differences can't accumulate that large. New SREs get a turn at doing the process. And so we started doing these fire drills. As I said, the first time it took 10 hours. The next time we got it down to 5 hours, about 20 bugs were filed, then 2 hours, then 1 hour. Hopefully a year from now, I'll be able to say that we have it down to minutes. So why is this important? Each time you do a fire drill, it surfaces areas of improvement. It helps each member have a turn at doing the process, so that builds confidence. It highlights needed automation and other resources. And so in conclusion, frequency reduces risk. And you can apply this to other things that outside of the traditional software engineering area. For example, desktop PC upgrades. I met someone a couple months ago who told me that his entire company was going to do their workstation refresh on one particular day. He was like, next Thursday, we're replacing 500 PCs. I said, wow, that's a big batch. And I said, have you considered doing like 10 the first week, maybe 20 the next week, small batches so that you could learn from some and get better? And he said, yeah, that would be a lot better, but we're not going to do that. I said, why? He said, oh, because my boss is an idiot. Okay. You laugh, but how many people have done too big of a batch in your software? Yeah, people are raising their hands. Okay. I see this all the time with email service. There have been presentations at this conference, actually, where people said, our plan was we got permission to take down the email server for like the weekend, and during that weekend we were going to move everyone's messages to the new email server, and that's so much better than trying to run two email servers at the same time. But during that weekend, things went wrong, and they weren't able to migrate everyone, and now this became an embarrassment for their department. So a small batch method would be, like I said, run two services at once and move people over in small batches at a time. It's more difficult to run two email servers at the same time, but the alternative, the big batch, just doesn't work. So you have to do it that way.
Look at the two servers going after the
right. This helps in relationships. Part of relationships is sometimes you have to give, you know, negative feedback. You have to give criticism. If you don't do that very often, if you keep silent until a big criticism comes up, then you're rusty. You don't have those mechanisms well practiced for the big thing. So, but if you develop a culture of being able to give feedback consistently all the time, then when you do have something big and scary and dangerous to talk about, those mechanisms are well exercised. It also works in weight loss. So years ago, I decided I was going to lose 40 pounds. And I said, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to lose 40 pounds. I'm giving myself 1 year. And a year later, I had not lost any pounds. And the reason for this is because I'm a bad person and I don't deserve good things. So I realized that, so I did a bunch of research and I learned that successful weight loss programs usually are a small batch, right? So I said, I'm going to lose 5 pounds and that's it. And I'm just going to repeat that 5 pounds and 5 pounds and 5 pounds. And I'm going to learn, you know, what works, what doesn't work. I'm going to do a weekly review. And that's how I was able to lose weight. So that's the small batch principle.
And the final thing that I mentioned earlier was minimum viable product, or MVP. So a minimum viable product is about delivering some value sooner rather than all value later. And delivering some value sooner is better than all value later. Well, what is value? It's features, stuff, goods, benefits to the company. It's something that is valuable to you and the company. So imagine that you're setting out to do something and it's a 10-month long project. You sit down, you make a project plan, we'll start here, and then 10 months time, we're going to launch it. And so you get down the road, 10 months time, you do the launch, yay! Oh, nobody likes it. Well, then you don't feel so good, your customers aren't happy, what's gone wrong? Well, if you were to take the minimum viable product approach, you would say, okay, I'm going to start with just a small set of requirements. Do the absolute minimum. It's not going to meet everybody's requirements. It's not going to serve everyone, but it'll serve a few people. It'll meet some little niche. And I'll do that, and then I'll launch it and see what people think and get some feedback and learn how to operate it and so on. And then I just repeat that, add a few more features, launch it again. Each little mini launch along the way gives me feedback, experience, and so on. The benefit of doing it like that is that you help some people sooner rather than trying to wait and help absolutely everyone at the end. You also get earlier feedback. So if people turn around and say, well, actually, I don't really like the way that works, you have a chance to change it and do something different before the entire company has been waiting for 10 months for this thing and not what they want. So it gives you a chance to pivot. When people don't like it, change what you're doing. Find something that they do like. And also the operational people get a chance to get some experience with the thing that you're launching early on and write some documentation, learn how to do failovers, how to do upgrades, and so forth. So rather than waiting until the very end when it's just kind of throw it over the fence, everybody in the company is using it, and the person on call is called out, and there's no documentation, they've never seen this thing before, so on. You've built it all up along the way. So the other thing that you get from the MVP approach is that if you're working on a project for 10 months, and 8 months in, it's canceled for some reason. There's no more funding. There's a more important project going on. You have nothing. 80% done is 0% done. You're not helping anyone. The whole thing's canned. The last 8 months, you might have been on the beach. So it doesn't feel very good. With the MVP approach, you've launched little bits of it all the way along. You're helping some people. management can see the value, and it's actually less likely to get canceled because you have all these happy customers who are there to advocate for you. And also, often the stuff that's coming at the end is the would-be nice stuff. It's nice to have, but in the end, it's not critical. So if the worst comes, you've still got something really functional out there, it's helping people, and the rest of the stuff is the icing that, okay, maybe you'll get to it sometime, but it's not such a big deal. So we don't just mean this in terms of releasing software. Think about something like automating your OS installs. You could start, say, right now, what we do is we carry a DVD around to everybody's desk and we stick it in and we sit there and we hit enter a load of times until it's finished and we go away. So let's change that to we want to boot from the network. Maybe you start with it only works on one VLAN, we don't customize the OS, we don't deal with any special hardware, but there's some set of machines where we can just boot them from the network rather than carry the DVD. Next, we might say, okay, we're going to eliminate all the prompts, so we don't have to sit there and say yes, 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 yes. And we can walk off and do something else, come back in a few hours, and it's finished. You can move on from there, customizing the OS, install Puppet, and so on. What you're doing by doing this MVP approach is you've built a framework that other people can use. So even if you don't have time to come back and support every single different piece of hardware that's in there, whatever, others can come in, they can add that feature, and they can do the stuff that's important to them. They're building on what you've done. And each time somebody makes an improvement, that's a new little mini launch. Another example, and this is a real example from a company, people that we know, they, friend of mine, they had a monitoring project. They weren't monitoring anything at the company, and they said, okay, we need to do some monitoring. We've got to know when stuff happens. So, you know, let's all get in a room, talk about what the monitoring system's going to need, and, you know, it's a big company, so we're going to need a really hefty server for this, and, you know, what are the various different types of software out there, what can handle what we're going to do, what the features in, and all the rest of it. And after 6 months, there's a lot of debates, a lot of disagreement, a lot of specification documents, and still nothing is being monitored. So they said, okay, we've got to change how we're doing this, because this idea of start here and in n months' time we'll have a full monitoring system, we can't even get it off the ground. So we'll try that again. This time, we're not going to try and solve all the world's problems at once. We are going to, at the end of this week, we will have something. We will have some free software running on a VM, and it will monitor a server. And they do that. At the end of the next week, they set themselves another small goal. We'll add in some routers. And as they do that, they discover SNMP isn't working and say, okay, well, isn't enabled on the routers. So, okay, we need to go and turn that on. Spin off a parallel set of people to go and do that. And then after this, they discover actually nobody's using it. So they go to all the people who've been clamoring for this monitoring system and say, what's going on? Oh, we don't really like it. We don't have dashboards where we can customize what we see for ourselves. Oh, in all our 6 months of discussion, not one person mentioned dashboards. Okay, well, chance to pivot, go and find something different, and let's focus on the features that people want. And if they had just done the one big batch approach, it would have been that you get to the end, you do the launch, and nobody's happy. So, plus for the MVP approach.
Okay. So, another place you might apply this is writing books. Now, you know, the other day someone said to me, Tom, I think every time I've seen you speak, you figure out some way of working in a book plug. And I said, oh, it's working. So for those of you who don't know, in 2001, Christine and I launched the practice of system and network administration. And just a little history. So then in 2006, we came out with the second edition. And in 2014, we took a little detour. People were expecting a third edition, but we came out with volume two, all new book about cloud system administration. And on November 4th, just a couple weeks ago, we finally came out with the third edition, which we launched here at this conference. The whole schedule was based around making sure it was out in time for Lisa. People often confuse, like, what's the difference between volume one and volume two? Volume one is all the enterprise-y kind of stuff, and volume two is all the cloud kind of stuff. It's easy to confuse, kind of like it's easy to confuse the Clash and the Ramones, but, you know, if you did that, that's fighting words, so you got to be careful. Now, we always had a kind of a DevOps-y attitude towards writing books. I mean, we used Git, because, well, or version control. How many people here remember VCS? Okay, yeah. We did it in LaTeX, so our words were source code with, you know, a compiler. We used make, so typing make generated, you know, the table of contents, the index, bibliography, the PDF, the mobile version, etc. But one problem that we didn't, a particular part of the DevOps system that we weren't doing. I'm sorry. We had a CI system essentially, but we weren't doing the minimum viable project. So for all the other books, we would start and we'd have like a 1 or 2 year deadline, and we'd work and we'd work and we'd work. And about 2 months from the deadline, we were 80% done. We had a bunch of chapters that were almost done. And so we had to spend those last 2 months working like crazy to finish everything. So those last 2 months were always very stressful. And to be honest, if you've ever read any of the middle chapters and it feels like it's kind of rushed, yeah, maybe that's why. So our third co-author, Strata, had this... Oh, sorry.
So for the third edition, we had a certain set of goals. What did we want to do with this book? Well, we wanted to fix the chapter order. We weren't really happy with the way it was. We had a load of new chapters we wanted to write, a series of chapters that were outdated we wanted to replace, and then do some updates to all the others. And we were heading down the usual road where we're sort of a pick up the bits that are interesting to you and work on them. And, you know, if you're hitting a bit of writer's block, pick up something else and work on that for a bit and whatever. And then Strata said, well, you know, hang on a second. We're making the same mistake again. Why don't we prioritize the things that we've got to get done and have our must-haves and, you know, next priority and so on, and work through this list before we move on to anything else, so that at every point in the project, we are ready to hand over a book to the publisher. So we can always just build it, pass it off. So we did that, and we, at every single stage, we said, okay, we're ready. You know, it's we finished this bit, move on to the next one, and so on. And if we worked really hard and didn't slack off at all, we would meet our deadline and get absolutely everything done. But if we slacked off a little bit, maybe there'd be a few updates that didn't happen, but we'd still have a finished, polished book that we could hand off to the publisher. If we slacked off a little bit more, well, you know, perhaps we don't update any of the old chapters. And if we slack off a little more, well, maybe. But the point is that at all points, the book was ready to go. So there wasn't that kind of last minute feel to it. So you can't kind of look through and say, ah, this is where they got a little bit rushed. This is kind of the last 20% stuff. So you'll never know how far along we got, because we're not telling. So there's the baby. came out last month. And in the end, it was the most enjoyable writing experience yet, because we didn't have that stressed, crazy last couple of months of finishing off all of the little bits and pieces. So that was about minimum viable product.
Right. So in summary, we talked a lot about a lot of things this afternoon. We talked about the three ways of DevOps is a way of taking a complex process and improving it. We talked about the small batch principle, which is about reducing risk and making better quality. We talked about the minimum viable product strategy, which is about delivering value faster. We also took some time to plug some books. And remember, volume one is the enterprise book and volume two is the cloud book. But if there's one thing that you remember from this talk, it's that you can do it yourself, anyone can do it, and everyone can be an artist. So thank you very much, and we have a little time left over for Q&A. Please come to the mic.
Hi, I'm Zach from ResOne, and my question is the minimal viable product approach. How do you do that when you're converting something like a large legacy app into something in a new code language or trying to completely just do a full rewrite?
Well, commonly when you're moving a large legacy system, the first thing to do is kind of surround it by a scaffolding of tests so that you know that as you're converting it to a different language or different system, you're getting bit for bit the same results. And I actually was involved in a project like this on a big financial system. And so first we built this, having that scaffolding was our first that was our first launch. And then our plan was to then go from there to making specific changes over time. Actually, fun fact, what we learned was we were actually doing some currency conversions wrong. And it was good that we learned that at like that first launch, not at the end, because now we had to change our plans to build a system that was bug for bug compatible and run with that for an overlap period. And then only after a month or two of that, we could then actually fix that bug and do the new features that we wanted to do on the new platform.
Thank you.
So I'm an ops person, mostly without dev, and I find that a lot of the books out there about trying to start using Agile are more for developers, and I love your talk. I'm also wondering whether your books or other books you recommend address sort of getting started with these kinds of methodologies in detail.
Well, actually, so the enterprise one is really going to be much more addressing the sorts of things you're talking about. This talk was really kind of a summary of the first four chapters in a way, which is trying to set the stage and say, you know, yeah, not everybody has developers. I'm in a part of the organization where we really don't have developers. We're also dealing with commercial software and, you know, most of the time you'd look at DevOps and say, how can that help me? But actually there's an awful lot of things that we can learn from DevOps that will make our systems a lot more reliable and so on, which is what we tried to capture in volume one. So highly recommend that particular
wow.
book.
Now she's doing the plugging. Thank you.
Hi, so I'm a sysadmin. A project we have ongoing at work is to do two things, to migrate from Red Hat Enterprise Linux 6 to Enterprise Linux 7, and to migrate from ad hoc desktop management scripts to a configuration management system. We figured we'd combine this into one project because it would take it'd be less work. If we were to upgrade to RHEL 7 first, then we'd have to manage RHEL 7 with the we have to extend the ad hoc management scripts and then write configuration management. If we do configuration management first, we'd have to write configuration management for RHEL 6 and for RHEL 7. But if we do combine them together, then we only write configuration management scripts for L7. Would you still advise breaking it up into those two parts?
Yes. So at Stack Overflow, when we did something very similar, we set a policy that as we moved any service over to RHEL 7, we had to puppetize the installation. So we not only that made us go a little bit slower, but it was a much better situation because and actually the way I would do it is if I converted a service, you know, step one was to just manually hand configure it to make sure I knew what I was doing. Step two was to puppetize what I had done. And then step three, I would wipe the machine and reload it and make sure that, you know, Puppet built what I thought it should build. We did that one service at a time for our whole CentOS 7.
But I mean, all of our desktops are identical, though.
Oh, well, then do particular users at a time or hallways at a time. Whatever works for your organization.
Or just pick a Thursday and do everything.
Yeah.
No, you're going about it the right way. I think, you know, put the two in tandem, and as you go
We do have some special cases. It sounds like the best approach is to handle the special desktop cases with later configuration management improvements.
Yeah. It'll also help get rid of those stragglers, because then you could go to management and say, look, we need your support on convincing people to move those last couple of machines. It's so expensive to support them. Everything there is manual.
Yeah.
If you try to puppetize both, then you've lost that leverage.
Or ad hoc scripts, yeah.
Right.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Hi, Colin Hicks from Edinburgh. I think two observations rather than a question. First one, I think to my memory, this is the first time I've been given relationship advice in a talk. And secondly, the Chris, you, I think, were sort of mildly annoyed earlier by some people in a project who didn't give you, I guess, the requirements correctly at the beginning, and decided, no, we want dashboards. I've been in quite a number of requirements gathering exercises. I've found that I don't know what I want fully until I see what I don't want.
Right, that's exactly the case, and that's exactly why doing lots of mini launches and letting people get their hands on it and discover, you know, that really doesn't work for me.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I saw that immediately when you brought that in, but I mean, your people that were that didn't know they want. I think they didn't know that they wanted dashboards.
Absolutely.
That's why they didn't
sure.
tell you.
Yeah.
And also, when you're doing little launches, it's a lot less scary to try something and undo it if people don't like it, or do things two different ways and let people do an A-B comparison. Yeah. I also want to take issue about your relationship thing, because I think you've taken my time management class. That's 100% relationship advice. My examples that are all system administration, that's just to trick you.
Oh, well, yeah, you fooled me then.
Thank you. Next.
Thank you for sharing your ideas. About the small batches principle, we have a conflict with, we try to do small batches principles, but downtime, the application downtime users sometimes are not amenable to have multiple downtimes for a release. So did you run into that kind of trade-off, or how did you handle it?
Well, for the most part, what you want to be aiming for is being able to roll things out without downtime. And that takes some effort and some thought of, you know, for example, if you have services behind load balancers, you know, you can take a few things out of action and upgrade and cascade along. And it really depends on, you know, if you're in the world of running commercial software, it really depends on the software you're running as to what mechanisms you have. But as you start rolling stuff out more frequently, you can figure out, how do I automate this? How do I make it go more quickly? And you can, if there is still downtime, you can minimize it because you've scripted everything and it runs through really fast. And each time you do it and you discover, actually, we tripped over this. You file a bug, and you say, we've got to fix that, or the documentation wasn't good enough here. File a bug, fix the documentation. It's exactly like the failover example that Tom gave.
Yeah, you're going to have the most downtime during the early launches, but maybe you say not. Maybe downtime, maybe your promise of low downtime doesn't kick in until the 10th launch. We're kind of out of time, so
yep.
We'd be glad to talk about this out in the hallway. Thank you all for coming, and enjoy the rest of the conference.